Professors FM.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Fanalytics Podcast, brought to you by Emory's Marketing Analytics Center. Joined today by Doug Battle. Sometimes I like to just start off with just taking it off the rails. Doug, you see this product I'm drinking here?
What in the world? Okay, so he's holding up Dr. Pepper.
But cream soda.
Cream soda? When did that become a thing? I haven't seen the ads for that.
It's just a thing. But what has become a thing, and I understand that this is largely sold out, is that there's a Texas ice cream company called Blue Bell who has partnered with a Texas brand in Dr. Pepper to make an ice cream product called Dr. Pepper Float with Blue Bell vanilla ice cream and the Dr. Pepper Sherbert. And
Sherbert?
Yeah, Sherbert. And instantly sold out. I wasn't even intending on going here, but when I said Emory Marketing Analytics Center, I was like, yeah, we should talk marketing once in a while. So like this idea of these two Texas brands with literal fan bases put these products together and just sells out. And you're not aware of this product, are you?
No. Blue Bell is fantastic, first off. Probably my favorite ice cream if I could have dairy. Back in my dairy days, Blue Bell was it. And it's just weird to me that they're mixing it with sherbet, because I thought a float was if you just mixed ice cream with the drink.
Well, I think this is how you replicate it. But you kind of want that product, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah. If it weren't sold out, I'd be there.
Kind of fun, right? I mean, it's a beautiful manifestation of fandom, right? It's like two brands that both have a special place in the heart of consumers. Put them together and it's like, oh, you got to have that. Okay, so, Doug.
Speaking of beautiful manifestation of fandom, Mike, did you see the Boston fan sitting behind Charles Barkley on the TNT set last week wearing a green shirt? I don't know if this was custom made. It says it's just a list. It's just no design work at all. Everything's set to the far left.
I mean, if it's not custom made, this story gets even better, doesn't it?
Yeah. So it says Putin, ISIS, Kim Jong-un, and Kyrie. So apparently they're ranking like people on a scale of, I'm assuming Kyrie's the worst of those four. So Putin's apparently the best, according to Boston fans. It might be problematic, but no. So Mike, I'm actually looking, there is a link to the shirt. So those are for sale on the internet. So there's more than one person that owns that shirt in Boston.
Well, it's a beautiful shirt, Doug, because as you were saying, it looked like a seventh grader made it.
Yes.
The way they did the graphics and sort of line things up, nothing is evenly spaced. It has no aesthetic appeal whatsoever. And you're reading, I mean, but it even, look, I'm going to give them credit, because as you're reading down your list, you're kind of going, well, this is interesting. What's happening here? And then you get to Kyrie. And it's like, oh, it all makes sense.
Yeah. So apparently Boston hasn't forgiven Kyrie for the way he handled his departure. Kyrie Irving, every stop he's been at has promised he's going to be there for the rest of his career. And within a year of that promise has departed. He did it in Cleveland. He did it in Boston, famously. And I mean, before the start of the season, he goes on the microphone in front of the whole arena saying, I'm not leaving. Like, Boston's my home. And sure enough, he leaves and then says he's not leaving Durant. Next thing you know, they're both out of Brooklyn. And he's gained some hatred over the course of his career. Between that and his, what's your term, Mike, for Kyrie's unorthodox views on things?
Independent thinker?
Independent thinker. Yeah, for his independent thinking. He has some critics for that as well. So love seeing that. But man, Celtics Heat has been a series for the ages. Mm-hmm. It's historic no matter what goes down in this series, because first off, if Boston were to come back, no team's ever come back from 3-0, period, in the NBA. I think it's happened 150 times. A team's gone up 3-0. Never has a team come back from that. So Boston would be the first team to do so. It's happened in the NHL, LA Kings, Stanley Cup run, 2014. But this is the first time in 20 years that a Game 7 was forced after a team being down 0-3. So,
yeah. It's a good thing. I mean, it reminds you of how this stuff is supposed to be, right? You know, this is the most memorable series of the playoffs so far, easily. Yeah. right?
Yeah. So this is a number from Emory student Jaden Rothschild. So after being up 10 points with less than 4 minutes left, Boston, in the game that would force a game seven, they were given a 97.9% chance of winning at that point, 4 minutes left in the game. So Miami had a 2.1% chance of winning with 4 minutes left, and they're up with 0.1 seconds left, with 3 seconds left, but they're still up with 0.1 seconds left. And then, of course, Derek White puts up the tip in for the win on the road. Miami fans are celebrating because they think he didn't get it off. Come to find out he did. Just absolute chaos. And so now you're looking at, again, a situation where Boston makes history if they make the finals, coming being the first team to come back from down 0-3. Miami makes history if they make the finals, mm-hmm. being, I guess, the first 8 seed to make it finals, I believe. And then in the finals, the Denver Nuggets have never won an NBA finals. So you've got a team that's chasing its first NBA championship, playing against, either way, a team that's had something historical happen to be there. It's almost like we talked a couple weeks ago about best case scenario for the NBA being Lakers Celtics. And I still think they would have preferred that. But we always talk about how the NFL always wins. It feels like this postseason, the NBA wins no matter what happens.
Yeah, but Doug, does it? I'm with you 100%. I mean, the series has been great. There's been some, you know, amazing, like sometimes we talk about fandom videos. There's one I saw on Instagram this morning where it's a bunch of Heat fans just talking trash to a Boston fan, and he's just turning back to him. He's wearing a Brady jersey of all things and just going, 3 seconds, 3 seconds. You know, just the tone of the fan bases, or, you know, I mean, the other thing going on is, you know, Dave Portnoy from Barstool has been very active in this space where, you know, he had a shirt printed up for, like, you know, Boston, a sweep, and then he had one Boston in 5, Boston in 6.
It might turn into Boston in 8 pretty soon.
But it just shows the absolute passion and hunger that especially, you know, a fan base out of Boston is going to have. Right. I mean, I've said this multiple times, you know, Boston is, and it kind of pains everyone that doesn't live in Boston, probably the best sports city in America. And it's kind of interesting, though, as you know, had the other example of the Celtics fan with the, I want to think it's a custom made T-shirt, Doug. I don't want to think those are a production.
They're for sale. I'm telling you, they're for sale.
But just the, you know, the absurd passion and how, and especially after a little bit of a drought, if, you know, that city will explode. Jason Tatum will, you know, reach a new level in terms of NBA fandom and passion. And so this is a case study. But here's my question to you. For us, we're watching this stuff. And so we're looking at this as, oh, God, this is a great storyline either way. Does the rest of America even know?
No.
And these games are going to be in Denver. Is anyone going to watch these?
I think basketball fans, like people who follow the NBA, are loving this, like more so than they would be loving Lakers Celtics. But no, the general public, I don't think it's the most appealing scenario. Jokic versus Jimmy Butler or Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown.
Appealing scenario. I think it won't even occur on their, it won't even appear on their radar. And I think that's part of the dilemma. Like, if it's LeBron, you know, the hype machine will go in full gear. When it's Jokic, you know, ask people on the street, is the NBA Finals going on? I suspect people would say, I have no idea.
I'm also curious with Jokic if there's more of an appeal abroad.
Yeah,
I don't know. Like, of course, where he's from, there will be, but I don't know in general if just international players in general draw interest in the international sphere outside of their home countries more so than national superstars. I'd be interested to learn about that, but I think you're right, Mike. I think that
I'll tell you one quick fact on that, because I saw this earlier in the week, or maybe it was this morning as well, that when the first time Yao Ming played against Shaq, I think the number I saw was over 220 million people watched it in China.
Yeah.
Right. Versus, you know, 90 million people watched the Super Bowl that year. I think it was 2003. Now, what I don't know is what European interest in NBA looks like. You know, I don't know how loyal they are to, you know, their professional leagues and how much, you know, crossover appeal there is. But I think it's, look, the NBA has long wanted to be an international league. So again, maybe we are setting this up where the NBA always wins. LeBron kind of blows up. Jokic makes this the most watched NBA championship series in Europe ever, perhaps.
Yeah, I think if you're the league, you can always look at it and view it as an opportunity, no matter what happens. And I think that's the situation we're in. I just, Mike, as a fan, I can't recall in my lifetime an NBA playoffs that have been this unpredictable. If anyone's been listening to the podcast, you've heard over and over again, me in the last 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks make predictions that have not come true. And frankly, for the longest time in my life, the NBA was just so predictable that you could just say, oh yeah, it's going to be Cavs, it's going to be Warriors, it's going to go to 6 or 7 games, you know, so it's like, it almost doesn't even matter until you get to that point. This year's just been a total free-for-all. I mean, a week ago, we were talking about Boston's coach looking like he was done, the Boston players looking like they had quit. I know on social media, there are people on or being critical of Boston relative to the Lakers and saying, yeah, the Lakers lost, but Boston quit. Like, this Boston team is done. The Lakers still have a shot. They still have fight in them. And as we've seen, like, even though Boston appeared to be totally out of it, and like, I am on record saying they're done. They are done. A week ago, Jimmy Butler's that guy. You know, he's got that Jordan, Kobe DNA in him where he's, well, literally maybe Jordan's. I know there's people that think he's Michael Jordan's kid, just like people think Anthony Edwards is. No, that's the whole thing, Mike. I'm serious.
I have seen that. It's like, Doug, if we're going to speculate on parentage, problematic parentage, we should just stick with the royal family. Prince Harry and Diana, I think.
And the horse trainer, is that?
Yeah, the polo player, I forget.
whatever, something with a horse. Yeah, but anyway, that's where the conversation was a week ago. And now it's like about how, you know, which speech was the one that changed things for Boston. And tonight's game 7, so by the time most people listen to this, it'll be over. But going into it, it's like, I'll say this, part of me wanted to come on here and say, there's no way Boston loses this thing after winning 3 straight and now playing at home. On the flip side, there's part of me that's like, it's been so bananas that Miami goes out and wins on the road because they play at their best when they're doubted and people are doubting them right now. That's their comfort zone. That's their sweet spot. Eric Spoelstra after game 6 in the press conference saying, we wish we could play them right now. Like, they are hungry. That I had read they already booked their flights to Denver for game 1 of the NBA Finals for the team. And I'd seen some commentary on that saying it's odd to go to Denver instead of Cancun when you're eliminated from the playoffs. But I think that at this point, I'm overthinking it in terms of predictions. I'm like, I want to pick Boston, but since I've been wrong about everything and that's what I think is going to happen, I guess I'll pick Miami. I don't know, but I love it. I'm locked in tonight. When the game's on, I'm locked in because I have no idea what's going to happen. And that, I think as sports fans, I think we crave that. I think we crave unpredictable. And I think the worst case scenario tonight is that Boston wins by 30, or I mean, Miami wins by 30 seems less likely. But I mean, if game 7 is anything like game 6, it is going to shatter all kinds of conference finals records.
Well, Doug, I looked it up while you were talking, and the Celtics are favored by 7.5 points.
That's crazy. In a game 7. Wow. I'm tempted to, I don't know. I don't know what to say. Anything could happen. Anything could happen. And in the finals, anything can happen. I know historically, if a team sweeps and another team, this is another one from Jaden, another team goes to 7 games. The team that sweeps in the conference finals is 4-2 in NBA finals. History against teams that have gone to 7 games.
I'm with you. Like, I mean, I think we've all been conditioned by the NBA to expect the narratives and the storylines to work, right? So the idea that this game 7 is going to have a 7 or an 8 point margin, it feels like the line should be like 2, doesn't it?
Yeah. But like I said, looking ahead, Denver chasing their first championship, Boston ending what is considered a drought in Boston, although, like, I don't know, what was it, Kevin Garnett those years? So it's been a while, but at the same time, it's been a lot longer for Denver. And of course, Miami's last one with LeBron in Miami prior to the bubble. Yeah. So it's been a minute for them as well. So
I guess the thing is, let me ask you this. Just thinking back on this season, Lakers making it to the conference championship, is that a failure? It's a decent year for where that team was at. I mean, it's always going to feel like a failure with LeBron if you don't win it all, right?
But here's my thing with that. It reminds me of Alabama's football season this year. This year, Alabama had the most talented team in Alabama history and all this stuff. And by the end of the year, everyone convinced themselves that Nick Saban did a great job to win as many games as he did with the team that he had. It was great coaching. It was great playing by Bryce Young. And wow, what a job they did. That's how I feel about the Lakers, where it's like the goal was to win a championship.
To do it with a 5'6" quarterback, I think. Who happens to be the number one pick in the draft, right? It seems like that's the story they want to tell in Tuscaloosa at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like this underdog story for Alabama. And it's like, to me, that's a joke. And I feel the same way with the Lakers, where like now people are saying, wow, this is a team that I don't know, did they even make the playoffs last year or hardly made the playoffs? They were 500 maybe a year ago. To make it as far as they did in the Western Conference Finals is straight up impressive. It shows a lot about LeBron. And don't get me wrong, I think LeBron had a great season. But for a team that has Anthony Davis and LeBron James and Los Angeles, where there's 17 banners, you know, I don't think there are any moral victories. And I, for one, am not incredibly impressed. My expectation is to at least, if that's my squad, if that's my roster, and I'm the Lakers, my expectation is to, at the very least, make the Western Conference Finals.
The Lakers, it's complicated. Okay?
Sure.
For Denver, is this a complete success, right? You've moved to a better zip code. You now have the best player in the league, almost undisputed, at least for the moment. Okay, for Miami, this is also
a win.
Great season. If Boston loses tonight, I think those fans are mad.
I think they're talking about firing the coach.
Yeah, I think
it's really crazy because it's like if they win this and they win the next series, that guy's getting a contract for the next 10. He's getting paid. He's Boston royalty forevermore. If they lose tonight, the story is that this team would have done it with the right coach. Because I don't know if you remember, Mike.
Doug, do you think it's also Tatum's a nice player, but he's not the guy. He's not the guy to take on the legacy of Bird and Russell.
Yep. I think it's kind of that. I think he's still in that Devin Booker territory of puts up great numbers during the season, fun player to watch, doesn't have that it factor. And I'm not saying that's the case. I'm just saying as far as narrative, that is how I think it's going to be perceived. And so it's so pivotal for these guys. The Boston coach, who, by the way, some of the most entertaining press conferences I've ever seen. Last week, I thought he was done after that Game 3 loss, and he looked just totally out of it, totally dejected, kept blaming himself over. It was like he wanted to get fired. Almost was like he had a death wish in his press conference. But I've watched his press conferences in the game since then where they've won. Same guy. Dude has no personality. He does not. I mean, it's like he doesn't blink when he's up there. And one interesting subplot of this whole thing that I personally love was that his college career came to an end at the hands of Jimmy Butler. And so how poetic would it be for either way if Butler were to do it again or if he were to get his revenge in the Eastern Conference Finals. And after all of Butler's taunting in Game 2 and 3, sending him, you know, to Cancun, it is such a great series. So many great storylines. And I just can't wait for tonight, Mike. I know that this is going to air before or after, rather, the game. And I'm hoping that next week we're talking about what a Game 7 it was.
Well, regardless, I mean, it'd be interesting to see how that plays out, right? Because if, like you're saying, if Boston wins, then, you know, that elite NBA brand has got it rolling again. And now they're taking on sort of this no-name team in Denver with this, you know, great European player. But if they lose, it'll be interesting for, we can come back to this next week and see what the reaction to that game is in either direction.
Well, I'm curious if Boston wins and they go on, let's say Boston wins the whole thing. Are they making a movie about this team, this playoffs? Because I don't know if you've seen this film, Mike, But the last Boston team to win a championship under very similar circumstances was the Boston Red Sox, breaking the curse of the Bambino. And Jimmy Fallon, starring in the movie about it, Fever Pitch, a rom-com centered around that baseball season. I would say it's a must-watch rom-com for sports fans. I know that's not a thing that gets said a lot. Must-watch rom-com for sports fans.
Doug, who was the female lead in that rom-com?
Drew Barrymore.
Are you guessing? I mean, it's a...
Hold on. I'm just... sometimes I get these actors and actresses mixed up. Let's see. Jimmy Fallon. Drew Barrymore. Yeah. I was right.
It's the first time we've gone down the rom-com path.
Have you seen it?
I have not seen it, Doug.
It's my second favorite rom-com.
Doug, what's your favorite rom-com?
Crazy Stupid Love with Steve Carell. Good stuff.
I've also not seen that. We can transition to a little bit. We've been watching Ted Lasso together for years now.
Yeah.
Are you caught up?
There, Mike, I hate it, but I am caught up and I feel like they've been reeling me back in. I was losing it with this show, but the whole dynamic between Jamie Tart and Roy Kent, man, that is golden. That is golden television. It's a beautiful bromance. And not to mention the love triangle with Keeley in the mix as well.
I've kind of softened my stance on it as well. I mean,
I was a hater. I was a hater like a couple weeks in.
That I don't hate it anymore. I think it's poorly done in a lot of ways at this point, but I don't hate it. So the manipulation has been sort of successful in terms of, bringing me back in. I mean, there's some stuff in it that kind of, and look, I know we got to suspend belief. The one that I found myself kind of going back and forth on was the idea that, and again, it's like we always feel like we're going to get in trouble, but honest emotion that Nate quit his job as a manager in the English Premier League. And I looked it up, and those jobs pay probably about $5 to $10 to $15 million because his boss kept trying to set him up with models.
Yeah.
Right. There's some of these elements of Ted Lasso that are like, I know you got to move the story along, but you got to do.
That's a rare guy. Statistically speaking, that's a rare guy.
His mom helped. I enjoyed that. That felt like it was coming back to season one.
Yeah.
They're getting me back. The manipulation works. I have a feeling I might shed a tear on that final episode.
I hate it, but it's like I keep finding myself like looking at, and like, is it Wednesday yet? And I'm like, man, I was hating on this show like 3 weeks ago, and now I'm here like, how are they going to wrap this up? What's going to go down between Roy and Keeley? What's going to go down with Jamie? What's going to go down? I mean, like I said, I think those three are that's the storyline. And I think when they started, when Keeley kind of had her own plots apart from those two, and I don't know, when the characters felt like they were going in a direction that I couldn't see where it was going, I was starting to lose interest. But they brought, I think it was when, well, spoiler alert, turn it off if you haven't watched this season, the bike lessons from Jamie Tart to Roy Kent. And I don't know if you laughed as hard as I did, Mike, but Jamie Tart's childhood bedroom, the posters on the wall in there, the two in particular, I'm trying not to spoil it, but I think if you've seen this season, you know what I'm talking about.
I wasn't paying, sometimes I watch this stuff kind of a little bit in the background. I wasn't looking at his wall.
So he had a poster. He had a poster of Roy Kent on his wall growing up. His dad or somebody mentioned, or his mom, who I thought was his sister, mentioned that he worshipped him growing up. And then right next to it, there's an inappropriate poster of Keeley. And apparently he had a huge crush on her as well.
Most of the laughs that I've had the last few weeks have involved those guys. And so it really is this, when Jamie is giving a gift to Roy and tells him he intentionally in front of Roy's niece and says, I misspelled your name with a U instead of an E.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like a comedy. So I guess those rare laugh lines, when it comes back to being a comedy, it's like, Yeah, this is solid. But it's like they've spent so much time getting away from that, making us want to, you know, tug at the heartstrings because of some trauma in Rebecca, who's probably a billionaire's, you know, sports team owner. You know, no, they've.
I think it, when it feels preachy is when they start to lose me, when I feel like I'm being preached at. But when I'm in a, and when I'm wrapped up in a story about characters, and you know, it might have the same message, but it just doesn't feel like it's being stuffed down my throat.
Yes, because that that's a great point. I feel like the other mistake they've made is a lot of the characters have not been adequately developed for how much they expect us to care.
Yeah,
right.
I think that's fair. Like they introduce kind of
and Van Damme the goalie. It's like. These guys may have had less than a page of lines the entire series, and now we're supposed to feel invested in their lives. And it's like, it's a little bit cheap, I think.
Yeah, and I'll say this on the flip side. I've heard speculation of future seasons of Ted Lasso spinoff absent of the character Ted Lasso. And I was talking to a friend about this who was saying, you know, that's going to be like The Office without Michael Scott. On this third season, though, I will say, I don't know if I've laughed a single time Ted Lasso has said anything. The first season, I laughed at everything that man said. Yeah. It didn't even have to be funny. It was like his character alone was just funny to me and his little quick. But it gets it almost feels sacrilegious to say this. It's one of those things where like I think we're all thinking it. No one's saying it. He gets kind of annoying. Like you start to feel like, okay, this is why his wife left him. This guy, these constant like dad jokes do get kind of old and kind of annoying. I sound like a terrible person right now. But you know, do you know what I mean? I haven't laughed this season from anything he's said or done. And I'm almost like, it's more about Roy Kent. So I'm like, if they make a show about Roy Kent and Jamie Tartt and these guys and follow them, like I'll probably enjoy it just as much as season three.
It's a good question. I mean, I remember when the first season was coming down and we're watching it, and I think we even did a ranking of the characters, and I had Keely Jones, I think, at the very top as kind of the glue character, and Ted Lasso up there. But yeah, I mean, and look, I think it's an interesting thing that at the end of the day, the two best characters, and again, you know, can they carry, you know, 50 minutes a week? I don't know. But the two best characters are Jamie Tartt and Roy Kent. And I think it has something to do with you and I are drawn to this kind of classic sports show, this, you know, this optimist, this incredibly optimistic character and a fish out of water and all of cliches. But God, those are two really well-developed and understandable characters. And so, yeah, learning how to ride a bike, you know, sort of having this kind of, you know, love-hate relationship.
Well, they're, very much.
They're getting up to work out at 4:30 in the morning, but they still are, you know, terrible to each other in some ways. It's, you know, I don't know, bromance? Is that what it is? Something?
I think it's a bromance, and I think it's like a classic bromance. I would say, you mentioned the development of these characters. I would say that I don't know if Ted Lasso has developed. I feel like they want us to think he has because they've emphasized his like mental health struggles more, but he's been having those this whole time and nothing's really resolved with, he still seem, I guess he's like the episode with his mom with the kind of F you and thank you part, I guess it's like he's learning how to like acknowledge his traumas and deal with them and not just distract himself and be funny all the time. But
Doug, that comes back to this kind of manipulation, right? Where it was like, so they developed this ultra optimistic kind of ultra dad joke, hyper dad joke character. And then because mental health is topical, they throw that in as one of his dimensions.
Yeah.
Right. So to me, it always felt kind of manipulative and forced, which is, I think, true with a lot of their subplots.
It's like if we were watching The Office and all of a sudden Michael Scott is dealing with OCD or something, and it's not a joke, like it's like in a very serious way, it's just, oh, that's a little out of left field to be for the show. It doesn't really feel,
Stanley has diabetes and an eating disorder, right? Yeah. It's too much.
It doesn't feel native to the genre or to the tone of the show. And so that, but the show's changed. I mean, it's kind of become more that than comedy. And that's where I think recently it's starting to come back to its roots. And that's where I'm starting to get roped back in. And
as they wrap it all up, right?
Yeah, as they wrap it all up. And I was getting to the point of the development of Jamie and Roy Kent. I think my favorite arc in all of television was like Steve Harrington and Stranger Things, which I know you haven't watched yet. And you're going to have to catch up before season 5. Fortunately for you, it's getting delayed like forever. Those kids are going to be like 40 by the time it comes out. But just a classic like redemption arc where like Jamie Tart was the kind of the villain for a bit. And all of a sudden he's the most likable guy. And almost too much so where all of a sudden Roy wants him to go back to his old ways because he's a better competitor when he's better for the team when he's a jerk. And that's G-rated way of saying it.
I think that's it exactly on what on sort of what's good and what's bad about this show. Jamie Tart was he was a great sports villain. Like, I mean, even when he was a complete jerk in season 1, there was something very kind of fun and likable about him. Right. I mean, because we've all seen that kind of character.
Yeah.
Then he hit hard times. And so you could argue that Jamie Tart is by far the most well-developed character on that show. And it's not like he actually gets that many lines. Right. I think he disappeared for a lot of season 2. Right.
Like he might get less screen time than 4 or 5 other characters on the show.
And Doug, I don't even know what's going on with his hair. But whatever it is, it's kind of inspired because it's sort of hateable to me. I can't even figure it out. And I suspect it's very kind of, I don't know, topical, popular. That's a legitimate hairstyle.
I don't know. I'm not going to be wearing my hair like that on the podcast anytime soon. But Jamie Tart can pull it off. Yeah. And then Roy Kent, of course, on the flip side, like kind of still...
Yeah. A beautiful one-dimensional character, right?
Yeah, he's like the most one-dimensional character and the best way. It's like he's begrudgingly developing by like the marginal increments and it pains him every single time and it's hilarious to watch. And that's like, that's not something I've seen much of either. That's something kind of new to me, not kind of a stereotypical arc or character. And I believe the actor is the one like writing that character. And it's hard to imagine him being anybody else. Like if I ran into that guy in real life, I would expect him to say a lot of F words and to have a soft spot for his niece and to have a love-hate relationship with some prima donna soccer player. It just seems like that's who the actor is. And I think he's probably the most universally loved character on the show.
Agreed. Agreed.
Even though the first season, my mother couldn't stand him because of his language.
Okay, Doug. The other thing I want to talk about this week is I had a phone call from a reporter who's asking me about Aaron Rodgers' impact on the New York Jets.
Yes.
And, you know, it's an interesting question, right? And we're about to, in a week, we're going to put the NFL fan base rankings out there. So next week's episode will predominantly focus on those. But why he was talking to me was a little bit different. It was like, which teams has the best vibe at the moment, right? So I'm not talking about sort of long-term fandom or long-term kind of brand equity, but who's got the most positive buzz. And I think Aaron Rodgers has been inspired in that kind of stuff, right? You know, going to concert in Madison Square Garden.
Was that Taylor Swift?
Yeah.
But we still got to do an episode for that. I think every celebrity and sports star and person I know has gone to that tour.
They've all got to touch the Swiftie, right? We should, right? Because I mean, who would have thought Swiftie has become a word that everyone knows?
Well, we need to have an expert Swift fan on here. I'm a casual Swift fan, but we need a diehard Swiftie. If that's you and you're listening, like shoot me an email or something. We can try to work it out. We need to investigate that a little bit more. Or maybe it's Aaron Rodgers. Maybe he's the diehard one.
I have a teenage daughter, Doug. We can probably find a Swiftie, but it's look, when I teach at Emory and ask them what people are fans of, I mean, it's amazing how many Swifties there are in this world. Yep. But so Aaron Rodgers has given some hope. Who else do you think out there in the NFL has some genuine good vibes? I was one thing like I could think like Baltimore with Lamar Jackson. But you know, is that kind of a painful one to get that done?
Yeah, I would actually, if I'm a Baltimore fan, I'm more excited about the offensive coordinator, Todd Monken, out of Georgia. I'm telling you, I've thought for a long time that this guy is going to be a head coach or should be a head coach in the NFL. And pairing him, I think there's going to be a bit of a resurrection of prime Lamar Jackson this year under Todd Monken as OC. We'll have to see, but I would be very optimistic. I think the biggest good vibes team right now, even though they lost the Super Bowl, is the Philadelphia Eagles.
Okay.
And I might, again, be biased to this because they've drafted like 100 Georgia players in the last 2 years, and all those guys are like best friends, like going to the NFL and becoming millionaires together. But I just see like Jalen Hurts. I think they have so many teammates on that team from college. Like Alabama, their offense has like 4 or 5 guys from Alabama. Defense has like 4 or 5, 6 guys from Georgia. And those guys all knew each other in the recruiting circuits and stuff. So it's the city of brotherly love, but it seems like that team has more of a brotherhood than any of the other. A lot of the NFL teams, it feels very, you know, these are professionals and these guys are just adult grown men who are going to do their job every day. And if they get traded, it's whatever. I don't feel like that with Philly. I feel like the players are as into it as the fandom. And the fan base, I mean, the fan base in Philly, as we know, has always been elite in terms of burning trash cans after winning championships and dancing in the streets. So
elite, but changing character. I think, you know, it's like, I don't think they're allowed to throw batteries at the players or ice balls at Santa
they
Claus.
They boo Santa Claus, though. That's elite. Yeah, that's an elite fan base.
A different generation. You think that's still? I hope it's
just it's tradition at this point. Yeah.
Well, okay. So Philadelphia has just paid their quarterback. They've continued to draft elite, high profile talent. So you think that's a fan base? It's look, coming off a close Super Bowl. I agree with that. That they feel like they're next in line to get there, perhaps.
And they're kind of a relatively young team in terms of they got a pretty young quarterback who's a leader, by the way, which I think is part of the good vibes I'm talking about. They've got this underdog, you know, Jalen Hurts, ever since leaving Alabama, has had this underdog storyline and not being a top draft pick and not, you know, they've got this underdog mentality, which really like suits the kind of like cold or blue collar Philadelphia kind of classic feel. I think back to that movie, I think it was Invincible, about basically the walk-on for the NFL team, but it's like Philly has this history of being these kind of underdog, gritty, like hard-working guys, and I think Jalen Hurts is that guy. And so to have a quarterback like that fits the culture of the city so well and culture of the fan base so well, I think is pretty unique and something that we don't see very often in the NFL. And then, like, you know, to combine that with like a lot of young talent, AJ Brown at wide receiver, like a lot of their top players are young guys who are going to be there for the foreseeable future. And I think there's just a lot of optimism in Philadelphia, and I think people are excited. And I'm kind of on the bandwagon, which is a little bit weird because I'm a Giants fan and lifelong Giants fan, and their rivals, the Eagles, beat them, have broken my heart so many times, eliminated us from the playoffs so many times. But and this probably says something about fandom too. As a Georgia Bulldogs football fan, the Philadelphia Eagles on their roster have more football players who I know their story and feel like emotionally invested in somehow than the New York Giants do. The Giants might have 2 or 3 players like that. The Eagles have like 5 or 6. And so I've caught myself, and I know a lot of Falcons fans that feel this way, you know, that are from Georgia and seeing what the Eagles have done in the draft, that feel like, am I becoming an Eagles fan? Like, I care about those players more than I care about the team I pull for. And I do think part of my bias might be because of that, but immaculate vibes in Philadelphia right now.
I feel like that makes some sense. And actually, the Jets story is kind of different than the Eagles story, right? The Eagles have been built essentially from the draft and the ground up, right?
Right.
And it looks like the Eagles are positioned for the good vibes are because they're positioned for a long-term run. Maybe they're at where the Chiefs were a few years ago, and on the other side, the Jets have kind of, they pulled off this coup, right? They got the guy, and we'll see if it works. If it works, it's only going to work for a couple of years. Okay, Doug, so I think we're going to wrap it up a little bit early. You know, this discussion about sort of good vibes in the NFL is a nice segue. When we come back next week, we'll start talking about NFL fandom. And I think, well, we'll make a decision where we whether we start from the top down or go from the bottom up. It's fun either way. There's you know, very few surprises in terms of who's going to be on each end of these things. But, you know, the big one is always the folks that find themselves on the bottom always end up being much more angry than how the folks at the top find themselves being sort of thrilled to be there. And now all that stuff will be out there at the website at www.fandomanalytics.com. Like, share, subscribe.